You're listening to the audio feed of The Demos, a series of essays about an anarchist's plan to end finance capitalism and replace it with an egalitarian union of equal members, so that real democracies can actually function within the nations comprising that international union. This article was originally published on April 3rd, 2025, and you can find the text version online at redthebean.net/blog.html. Today's episode is titled Pragmatic Humanism, or IFS Part 1, Sympathy and Righteous Anger Are Not Bad Parts. Pragmatic Humanism, or IFS Part 1. Sympathy and Righteous Anger Are Not Bad Parts. There is a method in clinical psychotherapy that is effective in healing the minds and bodies that are at the highest risk of causing violent harm to themselves or others and dying by suicide. This method was developed by trial and error, working one-on-one with individuals from that high-risk demographic, by someone who decided that the measure of success depended on the individual's experiences and healing. The method took years to develop, and it developed, again, from the bottom up. The people in danger spoke and were heard, and were heard, and were heard again. Through exhaustive work, a language formed that could speak helpfully back to them. The same thing is needed now in the world, to heal broken people, who have been broken not by their own faults or failures, but by contexts that have ignored their voices so long they can no longer tell what any of those people are saying. The powers that be are deaf to the voices of the poor, and the poor, desperate to be heard, have been trying helplessly to learn the language of the powerful so some change might take place, some empathy might be extended to them. But when someone's dying, suffering, and scared, the onus to make communication possible is on the one who must give and must listen. If you're someone who has the wherewithal to consider yourself an activist, then you are the person who must find others like you to do the good work you are longing to do, because you want to do it, and that is what makes you potentially able. In the last article, I gave a summary of the unified game plan that I've devised to get us all out of finance capitalism and into a genuine democracy everywhere on Earth. It might fail, it might never even be properly tried, but at least it makes sense, and in theory, it will work if we understand and stick to it together for the benefit of us all. The plan, in sum, again, is to organize transnationally an economic union, not funded or controlled by any state, and certainly not in the interest of any one state over any other, to understand and spread the logic of how the superstructure of our international monetary policies and institutions perpetuate their own logic, which is now and has long been autocratic dictatorship, and to commit democratically to the aim of demanding such policies and institutions are transformed into, even destroyed and replaced by, if it pleases you to frame it that way, an international clearing union with a common currency, comprised of both debt and surplus recycling mechanisms at its heart. The details of that scheme I will go into more thoroughly in my next blog. For this discussion, I want to make clear the psychological underpinnings of why this plan makes sense for us, the citizens of the world, as human beings, in society, together, given who we are and how we are politically, emotionally, and physiologically. Despite attempts to replicate human creativity and intelligence with large language models and the like, the troublesome rub remains. Each one of us is a biological organism, born an infant, developing through stages of growth and decay, and mortal. Each of us will die. The thoughts we have aren't metaphysical. The thoughts we have aren't separate from our experiences. The thoughts we have come from and serve to sustain and protect one thing, our living bodies in our natural environment. The word artificial is related to the word artifice, something a person made. Yet all that people make is made of what exists, just as we do, in the natural world, dictated by nature's laws. This is all to say, the world we build is partly ours and partly in control of us, and it would be futile for us to try to deny that which we cannot change or hope to even properly understand. There are aspects of our reality that require us to adapt, to submit, to conform to our circumstances, not because of any divine morality, but because of natural necessity. This is also true for our social psychology to an extent. The social organizations that have dominated our history were in part intentional and in part accidental, coincidental, chaotic. Though we cannot be in full control, it would not make sense for us to ignore the ways in which we are in control just because of that. Therefore, the intentional part of our social organization can be rational, intentional, and wise. There are certain foundations upon which we can build a home. There may always be a context out of our total control, but we can try our best with what we do know. The method for treating severe trauma mentioned above is called internal family systems, or IFS. The name comes from the fact that the developer used a technique from group or family counseling to help individuate parts of individuals when working with trauma patients one-on-one. The discovery, if any, was that individuals can be understood as comprised of parts, all governed by the holistic union of them, which can be considered the self. In the act of seeing the self as having parts, parts can be understood as psychical individuals, like little persons living within the individual body. In the past, the concept of multiple personality disorder has led to something of a general avoidance and stigma with regard to people having several personalities. The idea that our personalities or different states or feelings might be so distinctive and independent as to be able to fight with each other or derail our own more executive functions frightens us at first, understandably. But for this discussion, the point is that using this construal to guide conversation and clinical work with severe trauma survivors is effective in relieving severe symptoms and lowering risk of self-harm and suicide. The major tenet of IFS is that the person has a self and parts, and that no parts are bad, even when they feel badly or act badly, so to speak. This is a bit philosophical, so let's go into this bravely and deeply, suspending critiques that often arise in the face of such theoretical leaps from colloquial talk. The thing to grasp and hold on to is faith in a moral, objective goodness of the intentions, the innermost essence of every part of every person. To take an extreme example, consider a serial killer, the classic villain. In IFS, the clinician would look at the part that commits such crimes with an aim to understand what its role is for the individual, what good it is trying to do. By taking an accepting approach to the part feels safe enough to show itself and speak for itself. In that process, it can grow and integrate into the whole person at the present moment, when it can find that there are new things to do that are more useful in helping the way it wants to help. In IFS, the aim is to heal the individual, to help the individual to grow and transform into the most conscious and harmonious potential of themselves. To do this, start by trying on the belief that every part of the person exists in some way to serve the person well. There is the suggestion that likely in early development, various circumstances and challenges led to the person developing parts to survive or be comfortable in such circumstances. Later in life, the parts persist, but can grow and change as any individual can grow and change. Oh yeah, you must believe that people change all the time, or IFS won't make much sense to you. Let's just grant that you believe people change and carry on then. So there are parts. No parts are bad. Parts each exist to serve a helpful purpose for the self. The self can interact with its parts. The parts, however, can avoid interaction. Imagine the internal system like this. The parts are a classroom of kids who've been living for a long time under very minor, scarce supervision because their teacher has fallen into a coma. The analogy is terrible because where are the parents, but let's just use it for what it's worth right now. Occasionally, the kids have ended up forming little factions, say, or organized into a little government of their own where certain parts act as leaders and others as workers and so on. But then one day, the teacher wakes up from the coma and starts to look around and try to resume the role of helping the kids to learn and play and get along. Naturally, the kids feel a bit disenchanted with the idea that the teacher deserves any attention, sleeping as she has been for so long. That's kind of the idea of interacting with parts at first. It takes a bit of time to rebuild trust with them and establish a relationship where they understand that you're not punitive or negligent and are wise enough to manage things in a way that benefits everyone and keeps everything safe and fun. Once the parts become more trusting of the self, and the self, that is you, are able to see your parts, and as having good intentions and being inherently innocent, no matter what habits they might have gotten into, you can begin to see the reasons why each part got started doing whatever it does. And in the case of bad habits like self-harming, for example, you can begin to think of and enable the part itself to think of new roles and behaviors it might even prefer now that your circumstances have probably changed, or at least your awareness has enhanced and allowed you to see the unwanted outcomes of certain strategies, which can motivate the attempts to find new ones. In the same way, the state or the government is actually just a part of humanity. It is humanity as a whole, that is our collective self. Each of us, in every walk of life, working any and every job, does what we do because we have good intentions for humanity, and in turn ourselves as a whole. Each of us is good, and whatever bad is happening can be understood as some outcome of circumstances, which, as a whole, we can do our best to avoid or mitigate or create protocols for responding to humanely. The whole act of industrial warfare, for example, I consider a kind of bad habit at that scale, originally erected as a shield against various anxieties and an attempt to achieve an impossible state of invincibility or omnipotence. But now that we have seen our whole history of devastating wars, the whole gamut of rotten schemes for power seeking and exclusion, we can see too that they have not served to protect any one of us from death and never will. Moreover, we can see that the enterprise of becoming the dominant authoritarian dictatorship also in the end just makes more work, more suffering, more danger for everyone. The novelty perhaps is that now we might also be mature enough as a society to venture to think we might be more intentional about how we even think about power, profit, and social governance. The downsides of the habits we have acquired over time are obvious to us. Perhaps, and hopefully, so then is the obvious next step to try something new, even in the sense that we now will actually try. That move is a taking control of our destinies to the extent that we might be able. It is not a conceit that we can be all powerful and control each atom of our universe. It's appreciating that faith is a part of us, albeit an often unconscious part, that in imagining what we have not yet seen can guide us as we build what has not yet been. That part of us, once we see it and appreciate its unknowable potential for good, is ready to do things we can't even imagine yet, but simply based on its conviction about itself, its determination to imagine and create, we can know it will be in our interests as individuals. And the more we see it in each other and see our potential as a group to do more together than we ever could alone, the more we can know it will also be in our interest as a population. The idea of a revolution often strikes us as something violent and filled with rage, and indeed, revolutions have often been just that. In the same way, when someone heals, against the odds, from severe trauma wounds that have caused terrible self-destruction and harm to the self or others, there is a kind of violence taking place inside the body and in the environment's routine that had thus far expected bad from such person. That is a kind of violence, the change from the familiar crashing cycles of inertia into the intentional falling into places where we can hear our harmonies. It is a disruption, and things will be lost as new things are gained. But obviously, there are times when death is welcome. The death of cancer cells, the falling of dead leaves from trees. In our society, the loss of certain things need not be feared as some kind of painful severing. In the act of pursuing a passion, in working for what one desperately wants and sees as possible to achieve, the moments of muscle strain or the loss of water and perspiration are the least of anyone's concern. It's like that here, in this moment of cultural revolution. In 2011, Occupy Wall Street protesters were passionate and committed and bonded in a shared ephemeral conviction that it is time for serious fundamental transformation. But when we were asked, "Do you know what you're demanding?" the response was somewhat discordant, somewhat too soft, and somewhat lost in the righteous anger that had driven us all there. But like the civil rights movement, the resistance to fascism and autocratic dictatorship has not died. It is still alive and working in every one of us. Believe it or not, even the rich hurt themselves by maintaining things the way we all do. It serves no one. Like how patriarchy hurts men as well as women, all oppression hurts both the oppressed and the oppressors, though the dominant narrative attempts to argue for its case. It is powerful for us not to react angrily, though our anger is fair and good too, and I feel it too very much, but to see that there is also the option to feel pity for such a desperate, disorderly society and government. People building weapons that destroy the very ground on which they stand, no matter how dissociated they may feel from this or that location. It is all of us who are in danger here, because it is all of us who only have each other to communicate and survive and be the human population. None of us are dispensable. None is stuck without the chance to change and grow and heal. Now, among many others, I'm sure, I have figured out what it is we are demanding in the civil rights and the Occupy movements. It was with us all along, but the language and the details of how we wanted to see it manifested have taken some more years to come around. The proposal Keynes made in 1944 and the explanation of the anthropology behind and within it from Graeber in 2011 and the call to reconsider it all again from Varoufakis in 2015 and my essays and imploring on Mastodon in the last few years since then, trying to put these all together in light of what I've learned from all of them and others, all of these contain the pieces we need to construct our collective response now. In every social movement we care to support, the movement for trans rights, for anti-racist policies and norms, for queer rights, for women's rights, and for a world with human sympathy and support for the vulnerable, like the elderly and the orphaned and the widowed and the disabled, all of those exist within a superstructure mediated by money, the political power of property rights and wealth. That power, that money, though it seems to take on a life of its own, is a part of all of us, in that it depends on our faith and its meaning to everyone else. It is a symbol and an agreement. It is a representation of our interest in working together and living within social contracts that minimally constrain us but protect us all equally, as each of us would like to be protected by one another. That implicit, intuitive contract of egalitarianism has been corrupted over time, but all of this must be forgiven if we are to move on from that and rebuild what has gone rotten. Instead of rebuilding what rotted, though, we will now build something we know from experience is very likely to be much longer lasting and not the sort to rot. It takes us rebuilding our faith in ourselves as individuals and then in others for us to be able to get ourselves out of this. Though part of you might say, "But there is no hope, there is no chance, all is lost." I must say gently to that part, if so, then you relax now. If all is lost, then why not let us try on this other idea for size and wear it around a bit and see where it goes, and you can keep an eye out to make sure we're not simply recreating the same thing that got us where we are now. That is what you are good at, after all, because it is. The pessimism and fear is there because that part sees the damage done, the pain caused, and the irrevocable losses. In fact, perhaps it desperately needs and wants time to mourn. That might be necessary. So when one mourns, one is gaining strength to live another day with new purpose. The fear of what has happened is valued as that part who has seen what we never want to see again. So it stays with us, and we mourn and feel that fear a bit forever. But with what life we have left, and for what generations are still to come, and in what space we might still have to live and try and heal some, let's do that fearlessly, wholeheartedly, with confidence, because change is always happening with or without our intent. Maybe all we need to do is see that deciding to believe a better world is possible is the only decision we need to make, and after that, the rest feel automatic. In my case, personally, Nothing but this idea for a transformation out of finance capitalism could soothe my depression or anxiety. Nothing would be worth living for if I could not find a way that made sense and did not fall apart the second I considered obvious problems like the military-industrial complex and the myriad details of the bureaucracies of international relations and organizations. It only made me feel like living to find a realistic, sustainable way out, and didn't call for suicide and didn't call for simply attempting vindication through rage, but held on to those feelings, respected them as reasonable and crucial to my understanding of the importance of the situation, and accommodated for them completely. This essay was originally intended to be an explanation and description of the IFS model, development and practice, and how those relate to the strategy I'm proposing for an economic union to transform international monetary policy and institutions. Part of the intent was to speak to the awkward situation in which I often find myself lately, where I talk about labor and the IMF, and someone online accuses me of being reformist and pandering to dictators and so on. The impression seems to be that since I'm not saying eat the rich and making guillotine memes, that I am a moderate, an ignorant American who has no idea how violent and impenetrable the real autocrats, the billionaires, and the military-industrial complex officials are, and how to beat them. That's a fair reaction to me, since I do dwell mentally in a space where violent actions with weapons and rage are not external but internal. That is, in my vision of our revolution, we know very well the rage that lives inside of us, the hatred for the evils that have been done and can never be forgotten or smoothed over. And that rage does power us, but it powers us to act in ways that the powers that be least expect and are least able to suppress or drown out. It powers us to act so intelligently as a collective that the logic of our demands is not ignored and cannot be ignored. The logic of our demands serves even those we are confronting. It serves all of us, everyone. It is because we have a plan that we need not lose our cool, because we actually possess what is more valuable to people, including people in power, than any amount of any currency a central bank could print or a credit card company could type into a ledger. The plan we possess is something even the powerful desperately need. And though they do not know yet that they want it, our power as the masses on whom their self-importance and self-respect truly depends will make it clear to them. We will help them understand, and our vindication will be greater than any revenge could ever be. But surely, I wrote this in an unstructured stream, and I moved through the ideas in this essay, hoping that the reader can and does move through them with me at whatever pace and in whatever way works. It is missing quite a lot of meat, sorry for that metaphor, and has a long way to go to include what I meant to include here, but perhaps out of some urgency, an attempt to curb my perfectionism and at least make progress, though I can't do all I want to do at once, I will post it now anyway, hoping it does more good than bad to help begin to communicate the plan I have and want and need to share and try. But whatever was left out in this attempt, I hope will make it into the next chapter. I'll keep working at writing about this and putting the pieces out in public for you to read. There's some element of faith in writing like this and sharing these this way, that in time, the part of me that knows what it knows can make itself clear to others. Part of me does fear I will fail to do that, and I will only be more and more misunderstood or attacked or ignored. But I have to try, and I hope instead it does exactly what it's trying to do, and we become more free by understanding and resonating with each other about what can unite and liberate us all. In solidarity, Rachel E. Solicia.